Chapter 103. From some voices, that speech might have sounded entirely reverential, and even timidly apologetic. Lush had no intention to the contrary, but to Gwendolyn's ear his words had as much insolence in them as his prominent eyes, and the pronoun "who" was too familiar. He ought to have addressed the folding screen, and spoke of her as Mrs. Grandcourt. She gave the smallest sign of a bow, and Lush went on, with a little awkwardness, getting entangled in what is elegantly called tautology. "My having been in Mr. Grandcourt's confidence for 15 years or more, since he was a youth, in fact of course gives me a peculiar position. He can speak to me of affairs that he could not mention to anyone else, and, in fact, he could not have employed anyone else in this affair. I have accepted the task out of friendship for him, which is my apology for accepting the task, if he would have preferred someone else." He paused, but she made no sign, and Lush, to give himself a countenance in an apology which met no acceptance, opened the folded paper, and looked at it vaguely, before he began to speak again. "This paper contains some information about Mr. Grandcourt's will, an abstract of a party wish you to know, if you will be good enough, to cast your eyes over it. But there is something I had to say by way of introduction which I hope you will pardon me for, if it's not quite agreeable." Lush found that he was behaving better than he had expected, and had no idea how insulting he made himself with his "not quite agreeable." "Say what you have to say without apologizing, please," said Gwendolyn, with the air she might have bestowed on a dog stealer come to claim a reward for finding the dog he had stolen. "I have only to remind you of something that occurred before your engagement to Mr. Grandcourt," said Lush, not without the rise of some willing insolence in exchange for her scorn. "Why, you met a lady in Cardle Chase, if you remember, who spoke to you of her position with regard to Mr. Grandcourt. As he had children with her, one a very fine boy." Gwendolyn's lips were almost as pale as her cheeks. Her passion had no weapons, words were no better than chips. This man's speech was like a sharp knife edge drawn across her skin. But even her indignation at the employment of Lush was getting merged in a crowd of other feelings, dim and alarming as a crowd of ghosts. "Mr. Grandcourt was aware that you were acquainted with this unfortunate affair beforehand, and he thinks it only right that his position and intentions should be made quite clear to you. It is an affair of property and prospects, and if there were any objection you had to make, if you would mention it to me, it is a subject which of course he would rather not speak about himself, if you will be good enough just to read this." With the last words Lush rose, and presented the paper to her. When Gwendolyn resolved that she would betray no feeling in the presence of this man, as he had not prepared herself to hear that her husband knew the silent consciousness, the silently accepted terms on which as he had married him, she dared not raise her hand to take the paper, lest it should visibly tremble. For a moment Lush stood holding it toward her, and she felt his gaze on her as ignominy, before she could say even with low-toned haughtiness, "Lay it on the table, and go into the next room, please." Lush obeyed, thinking as he took an easy chair in the back drawing room, "My lady winces considerably." She didn't know what would be the charge for that superfine article, Henley Grandcourt. But it seemed to him that a penniless girl had done better than as he had any right to expect, and that as he had been uncommonly knowing for her years and opportunities. Her words to Lydia meant nothing, and her running away had probably been part of her adroitness. It had turned out a master stroke. Meanwhile, Gwendolyn was rallying her nerves to the reading of the paper. She must read it. Her whole being, pride, longing for rebellion, dreams of freedom, remorseful conscience, dread of fresh visitation all made one need to know what the paper contained. But at first it was not easy to take in the meaning of the words. When as he had succeeded, she found that in the case of there being no son as issue of her marriage, Grandcourt had made the small Henley his heir, that was all she cared to extract from the paper with any distinctness. The other statement, as to what provision would be made for her in the same case, she hurried over, getting only a confused perception of thousands and Gadsmir. It was enough. She could dismiss the man in the next room with the defiant energy which had revived in her at the idea that this question of property and inheritance was meant as a finish to her humiliations and her thraldom. She thrust the paper between the leaves of her book, which she took in her hand, and walked with her stateliest air into the next room, where Lush immediately arose, awaiting her approach. When she was 4 yards from him, it was hardly an instant that she paused to say in a high tone, while she swept him with her eyelashes, "Tell Mr. Grandcourt that his arrangements are just what I desired," passing on without haste, and leaving Lush time to mingle some admiration of her graceful back with that half-amused sense of her spirit and impertinence, which he expressed by raising his eyebrows and just thrusting his tongue between his teeth. He really did not want her to be worse punished, and he was glad to think that it was time to go and lunch at the club, where he meant to have a lobster salad. What did Gwendolyn look forward to? When her husband returned, he found her equipped in her riding dress, ready to ride out with him. She was not again going to be hysterical, or take to her bed and say she was ill. That was the implicit resolve adjusting her muscles, before she could have framed it in words, as she walked out of the room, leaving Lush behind her. She was going to act in the spirit of her message, and not to give herself time to reflect. She rang the bell for her maid, and went with the usual care through her change of toilet. Doubtless her husband had meant to produce a great effect on her. By and by perhaps she would let him see an effect the very opposite of what he intended. But at present all that she could show was a defiant satisfaction in what had been presumed to be disagreeable. It came as an instinct, rather than a thought, that to show any sign which could be interpreted as jealousy, when S.E. had just been insultingly reminded that the conditions were what S.E. had accepted with her eyes open, would be the worst self-humiliation. She said to herself that as he had not time today to be clear about her future actions, all she could be clear about was that she would match her husband in ignoring any ground for excitement. She not only rode, but went out with him to dine, contributing nothing to alter their mutual manner, which was never that of rapid interchange in discourse. And curiously enough she rejected a handkerchief on which her maid had by mistake put the wrong scent, a scent that Grandcourt had once objected to. Gwendolyn would not have liked to be an object of disgust to this husband whom she hated. She liked all disgust to be on her side. But to defer thought in this way was something like trying to talk without singing in her own ears. The thought that is bound up with our passion is as penetrative as air. Everything is porous to it. Bows, smiles, conversation, repartee, are mere honeycombs where such thoughts rushes freely, not always with a taste of honey. And without shutting herself up in any solitude, Gwendolyn seemed at the end of 9 or 10 hours to have gone through a labyrinth of reflection, in which already the same succession of prospects had been repeated, the same fallacious outlets rejected, the same shrinking from the necessities of every course. Already she was undergoing some hardening effect from feeling that she was under eyes which saw her past actions solely in the light of her lowest motives. She lived back in the scenes of her courtship, with the new bitter consciousness of what had been in Grandcourt's mind certain now, with her present experience of him, that he had a peculiar triumph in conquering her dumb repugnance, and that ever since their marriage he had had a cold exultation in knowing her fancied secret. Her imagination exaggerated every tyrannical impulse he was capable of. I will insist on being separated from him was her first darting determination. Then, I will leave him, whether he consents or not. If this boy becomes his heir, I have made an atonement. But neither in darkness nor in daylight could she imagine the scenes which must carry out those determinations with the courage to feel them endurable. How could she run away to her own family, carry distress among them, and render herself an object of scandal in the society as he had left behind her? What future lay before her as Mrs. Grandcourt gone back to her mother, who would be made destitute again by the rupture of the marriage for which one chief excuse had been that it had brought that mother a maintenance. As he had lately been seeing her uncle and Anna in London, and though as he had been saved from any difficulty about inviting them to stay in Grosvenor Square by their wish to be with Rex, who would not risk a meeting with her, the transient visit as he had had from them helped now in giving stronger color to the picture of what it would be for her to take refuge in her own family. What could she say to justify her flight? Her uncle would tell her to go back. Her mother would cry. Her aunt and Anna would look at her with wondering alarm. Her husband would have power to compel her. As he had absolutely nothing that she could allege against him in judicious or judicial ears. And to insist on separation. That was an easy combination of words, but considered as an action, to be executed against Grandcourt, it would be about as practicable as to give him a pliant disposition, and a dread of other people's unwillingness. How was she to begin? What was she to say that would not be a condemnation of herself? If I am to have misery anyhow, was the bitter refrain of her rebellious dreams, I had better have the misery that I can keep to myself. Moreover, her capability of rectitude told her again and again that as he had no right to complain of her contract, or to withdraw from it. And always among the images that drove her back to submission was Deronda. The idea of herself separated from her husband gave Deronda a changed, perturbing, painful place in her consciousness. Instinctively she felt that the separation would be from him too, and in the prospective vision of herself as a solitary, dubiously regarded woman, she felt some tingling bashfulness at the remembrance of her behavior towards him. The association of Deronda with a dubious position for herself was intolerable. And what would he say if he knew everything? Probably that she ought to bear what as he had brought on herself, unless she were sure that she could make herself a better woman by taking any other course. And what sort of woman was she to be solitary, sickened of life, looked at with a suspicious kind of pity? Even if she could dream of success in getting that dreary freedom, Mrs. Grandcourt on the way would be a more pitiable creature than Gwendolyn Harleth condemned to teach the bishop's daughters, and to be inspected by Mrs. Mompert. One characteristic trait in her conduct is worth mentioning. She would not look a second time at the paper Lush had given her, and before ringing for her maid she locked it up in a traveling desk which was at hand, proudly resolved against curiosity about what was allotted to herself in connection with Gadsmere, feeling herself branded in the minds of her husband and his confidant with the meanness that would accept marriage and wealth on any conditions, however dishonorable and humiliating. Day after day the same pattern of thinking was repeated. There came nothing to change the situation, no new elements in the sketch, only a recurrence which engraved it. The May weeks went on into June, and still Mrs. Grandcourt was outwardly in the same place, presenting herself as she was expected to do in the accustomed scenes, with the accustomed grace, beauty, and costume, from church at one end of the week, through all the scale of desirable receptions, to opera at the other. Church was not markedly distinguished in her mind from the other forms of self-presentation, for marriage had included no instruction that enabled her to connect liturgy and sermon with any larger order of the world than that of unexplained and perhaps inexplicable social fashions. While a laudable zeal was laboring to carry the light of spiritual law up the alleys, where law is chiefly known as the policeman, the brilliant Mrs. Grandcourt, condescending a little to a fashionable rector and conscious of a feminine advantage over a learned dean, was, so far as pastoral care and religious fellowship were concerned, in as complete a solitude as a man in a lighthouse. Can we wonder at the practical submission which hid her constructive rebellion? The combination is common enough, as we know from the number of persons who make us aware of it in their own case by a clamorous unwearied statement of the reasons against their submitting to a situation which, on inquiry, we discover to be the least disagreeable within their reach. Poor Gwendolyn had both too much, and too little mental power and dignity to make herself exceptional. No wonder that Deronda now marked some hardening in a look and manner which were schooled daily to the suppression of feeling. For example, one morning, riding in Rotten Row with Grandcourt by her side, she saw standing against the railing at the turn, just facing them, a dark-eyed lady with a little girl and a blonde boy, whom she at once recognized as the beings in all the world the most painful for her to behold. She and Grandcourt had just slackened their pace to a walk. He being on the outer side was the nearer to the unwelcome vision, and Gwendolyn had not presence of mind to do anything but glance away from the dark eyes that met hers piercingly toward Grandcourt, who wheeled past the group with an unmoved face, giving no sign of recognition. Immediately she felt a rising rage against him mingling with her shame for herself, and the words, "You might at least have raised your hat to her," flew impetuously to her lips, but did not pass them. If as her husband, in her company, he chose to ignore these creatures whom she herself had excluded from the place she was filling, how could she be the person to reproach him? She was dumb. It was not chance, but her own design, that had brought Mrs. Glasher there with her boy. As he had come to town under the pretext of making purchases, really wanting educational apparatus for her children, and had had interviews with Lush in which as he had not refused to soothe her uneasy mind, by representing the probabilities as all on the side of her ultimate triumph. Let her keep quiet, and she might live to see the marriage dissolve itself in one way or other. Lush hinted at several ways leaving the succession assured to her boy. As he had had an interview with Grandcourt too, who had as usual told her to behave like a reasonable woman, and threatened punishment if she were troublesome, but had also as usual vindicated himself from any wish to be stingy, the money he was receiving from Sir Hugo on account of Diplo encouraging him to be lavish. Lydia, feeding on the probabilities in her favor, devoured her helpless wrath along with that pleasanter nourishment, but she could not let her discretion go entirely without the reward of making a Medusa apparition before Gwendolyn. Vindictiveness and jealousy finding relief in an outlet of venom, though it were as futile as that of a viper already flung on the other side of the hedge. Hence, each day, after finding out from Lush the likely time for Gwendolyn to be riding, as he had watched at that post, daring Grandcourt so far, why should she not take little Henley into the park? The Medusa apparition was made effective beyond Lydia's conception by the shock it gave Gwendolyn actually to see Grandcourt ignoring this woman who had once been the nearest in the world to him, along with the children she had borne him. And all the while the dark shadow thus cast on the lot of a woman destitute of acknowledged social dignity spread itself over her visions of a future that might be her own, and made part of her dread on her own behalf. She shrank all the more from any lonely action. What possible release could there be for her from this hated vantage ground, which yet she dared not quit, any more than if fire had been raining outside it? What release, but death? Not her own death. Gwendolyn was not a woman who could easily think of her own death as a near reality, or front for herself the dark entrance on the untried and invisible. It seemed more possible that Grandcourt should die. And yet not likely. The power of tyranny in him seemed a power of living in the presence of any wish that he should die. The thought that his death was the only possible deliverance for her was one with the thought that deliverance would never come, the double deliverance from the injury with which other beings might reproach her, and from the yoke as he had brought on her own neck. No. She foresaw him always living, and her own life dominated by him. The ways of her young experience not stretching beyond the few immediate years that seemed immeasurably long with her passionate weariness. The thought of his dying would not subsist. It turned as with a dream change into the terror that she should die with his throttling fingers on her neck avenging that thought. Fantasies moved within her like ghosts, making no break in her more acknowledged consciousness and finding no obstruction in it. Dark rays doing their work invisibly in the broad light. Only an evening or two after that encounter in the park, there was a grand concert at Klezmer's, who was living rather magnificently now in one of the large houses in Grosvenor Place, a patron and prince among musical professors. Gwendolyn had looked forward to this occasion as one on which she was sure to meet Deronda, and as he had been meditating how to put a question to him which, without containing a word, that she would feel a dislike to utter, would yet be explicit enough for him to understand it. The struggle of opposite feelings would not let her abide by her instinct, that the very idea of Deronda's relation to her was a discouragement to any desperate step towards freedom. The next wave of emotion was a longing for some word of his to enforce a resolve. The fact that her opportunities of conversation with him had always, to be snatched in the doubtful privacy of large parties, caused her to live through them many times beforehand, imagining how they would take place, and what she would say. The irritation. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.